Bring it here. I
Disturbed visages of magicians stared from Reshum Bibi to me, because although they were a people who denied the supernatural, they were artists, and like all performers, had an implicit faith in luck. Good luck and bad luck. Luck.
Yourself, you said, Reshum Bibi wailed. This man is born twice, and not even from woman. Now comes desolation, pestilence, and death. I am old, and so I know, Ari Baba.
She turned plaintively to face me.
Have pity on me. Go now, go, quick.
There was a murmur.
It is true, Reshum Bibi knows the old stories.
But then Picture Singh became angry.
The captain is my honored guest, he said. He stays in my hut as long as he wishes, for short or for long. What are you all talking? This is no place for fables.
Salim Sanai's first sojourn at the magician's ghetto lasted only a matter of days. But during that short time, a number of things happened to allay the fears which had been raised by I.O.I.O. The plain, unadorned truth is that in those days, the ghetto illusionists and other artists began to hit new peaks of achievement. Jugglers managed to keep 1,001 balls in the air at a time, and a fakir's as-yet-untrained protégé strayed onto a bed of hot coals only to stroll across it unconcerned, as though she had acquired her mentor's gifts by osmosis. I was told that the rope trick had been successfully performed. Also, the police failed to make their monthly raid on the ghetto, which had not happened within living memory. And the camp received a constant stream of visitors, the servants of the rich requesting the professional services of one or more of the colony at this or that gala evening's entertainment. It seemed, in fact, as though Reshum Bibi had got things the wrong way round. And I rapidly became very popular in the ghetto. I was dubbed Salim Kismeti, Lucky Salim. Poverty was congratulated on having brought me to the slum. And finally, Picture Singh brought Reshum Bibi to apologize.
"Apologize,"
Reshum said toothlessly, and fled. Picture Singh added,
"It is hard for the old ones. Their brains go raw and remember upside down. Captain, here everyone is saying you are our luck. But will you go from us soon?"
And Parvati, staring dumbly with saucer eyes, which begged, "No, no, no." But I was obliged to answer in the affirmative. Salim, today, is certain that he answered, "Yes." That on the self-same morning, still dressed in shapeless robes, still inseparable from a silver spittoon, he walked away, without looking back at a girl who followed him with eyes moistened with accusations that, strolling hastily past practicing jugglers and sweetmeat stalls, which filled his nostrils with the temptations of rasgullas, past barbers offering shaves for 10 paisa, past the derelict maunderings of crones and the American-accented caterwauls of shoeshine boys who importuned busloads of Japanese tourists in identical blue suits and incongruous saffron turbans which had been tied around their heads by obsequiously mischievous guides, past the towering flight of stairs to the Friday mosque, past vendors of notions and itter essences and plaster of Paris replicas of the Qutb Minar, and painted toy horses and fluttering unslaughtered chickens, past invitations to cockfights and empty-eyed games of cards, he emerged from the ghetto of the illusionists and found himself on Faiz Bazaar, facing the infinitely extending walls of a red fort, from whose ramparts a prime minister had once announced independence, and in whose shadow a woman had been met by a peep-show merchant, a Dili Deco man who had taken her into narrowing lanes to hear her son's future foretold amongst mongoose and vultures and broken men with leaves bandaged around their arms that, to be brief, he turned to his right and walked away from the old city towards the roseate palaces built by pink-skinned conquerors long ago. Abandoning my saviours, I went into New Delhi on foot. Why? Why, ungratefully spurning the nostalgic grief of Parvati the witch, did I set my face against the old and journey into newness? Why, when for so many years I had found her my staunchest ally in the nocturnal congresses of my mind, did I leave her so lightly in the morning? Fighting past fissured blanks, I am able to remember two reasons, but am unable to say which was paramount, or if a third. Firstly, at any rate, I had been taking stock. Salim, analysing his prospects, had had no option but to admit to himself that they were not good. I was passportless, in law an illegal immigrant, having once been a legal emigrant. POW camps were waiting for me everywhere. And even after setting aside my status as defeated soldier on the run, the list of my disadvantages remained formidable. I had neither funds nor a change of clothes, nor qualifications, having neither completed my education nor distinguished myself in that part of it which I had undergone. How was I to embark on my ambitious project of nation-saving without a roof over my head or a family to protect, support, assist? It struck me like a thunderclap that I was wrong, that here, in this very city, I had relatives, and not only relatives, but influential ones. My uncle Mustafa Aziz, a senior civil servant, who, when last heard of, had been number two in his department. What better patron than he for my messianic ambitions? Under his roof, I could acquire contacts as well as new clothes. Under his auspices, I would seek preferment in the administration, and, as I studied the realities of government, would certainly find the keys of national salvation. And I would have the ears of ministers. I would perhaps be on first-name terms with the great. It was in the clutches of this magnificent fantasy that I told Parvati the witch, I must be off, great matters are afoot, and seeing the hurt in her suddenly inflamed cheeks, consoled her. I will come and see you often, often, often. But she was not consoled. High-mindedness, then, was one motive for abandoning those who had helped me. But was there not something meaner, lowlier, more personal? There was. Parvati had drawn me secretly aside, behind a tin and cratewood shack, where cockroaches spawn, where rats made love, where flies gorged themselves on pie dog dung. She clutched me by the wrist and became incandescent of eye and sibilant of tongue. Hidden in the putrid underbelly of the ghetto, she confessed that I was not the first of the midnight children to have crossed her path. And now there was a story of a Dhaka procession and magicians marching alongside heroes. There was Parvati looking up at a tank, and there were Parvati eyes alighting on a pair of gigantic prehensile knees, knees bulging proudly through starched, pressed uniform. There was Parvati crying, "Oh, you! Oh, you!" And then the unspeakable name, the name of my guilt, of someone who should have led my life, but for a crime in a nursing home. Parvati and Shiva. Shiva and Parvati, fated to meet by the divine destiny of their names, were united in the moment of victory. "A hero man," she hissed proudly behind the shack. "They will make him a big officer and all." And now, what was produced from a fold of her ragged attire? What once grew proudly on a hero's head and now nestled against a sorceress's breasts? "I asked, and he gave," said Parvati the witch, "and showed me. a lock of his hair. Did I run from that lock of fateful hair? Did Salim, fearing a reunion with his alter ego, whom he had so long ago banned from the councils of the night, flee back into the bosom of that family whose comforts had been denied the war hero? Was it high-mindedness or guilt? I can no longer say. I set down only what I remember, namely that Parvati the witch whispered, "Maybe he will come when he has time, and then we will be three." And another repeated phrase, "Midnight's children, yah, that's something, no?" Parvati the witch reminded me of things I had tried to put out of my mind, and I walked away from her to the home of Mustafa Aziz. Of my last miserable contact with the brutal intimacies of family life, only fragments remain. However, since it must all be set down and subsequently pickled, I shall attempt to piece together an account. To begin with, then, let me report that my Uncle Mustafa lived in a commodiously anonymous civil service bungalow set in a tidy civil service garden just off Rajpath, in the heart of Lutyens' city. I walked along what had once been Kingsway, breathing in the numberless perfumes of the street, which blew out of state handicraft emporia and the exhaust pipes of auto rickshaws. The aromas of banyan and deodar mingled with the ghostly scents of long-gone viceroys and memsabs in gloves, and also with the rather more strident bodily odours of gaudy rich begums and tramps. Here was the giant election scoreboard, around which, during the first battle for power between Indra and Moraji Desai, crowds had thronged, awaiting the results, asking eagerly, "Is it a boy or a girl?" Amid ancient and modern, between Indigate and the Secretariat buildings, my thoughts teeming with vanished Mughal and British empires, and also with my own history. Because this was the city of public announcement, of many-headed monsters, and a hand falling from the sky. I marched resolutely onwards, smelling, like everything else in sight, to high heaven. And at last, having turned left towards Duplex Road, I arrived at an anonymous garden with a low wall and a hedge, in a corner of which I saw a signboard waving in the breeze, just as once signboards had flowered in the gardens of Methil's estate. But this echo of the past told a different story. "Not for sale." With its three ominous vowels and four fateful consonants, the wooden flower of my uncle's garden proclaimed strangely, "Mr. Mustafa Aziz and Fly." Not knowing that the last word was my uncle's habitual desiccated abbreviation of the throbbingly emotional noun family, I was thrown into confusion by the nodding signboard. After I had stayed in his household for a very short time, however, it began to seem entirely fitting, because the family of Mustafa Aziz was indeed as crushed, as insect-like, as insignificant as that mythically truncated fly. With what words was I greeted when, a little nervously, I rang a doorbell, filled with hopes of beginning a new career? What face appeared behind the wire-netted outer door and scowled in angry surprise? Padma, I was greeted by Uncle Mustafa's wife, by my mad aunt Sonia, with the exclamation, "Butwi, Allah, how the fellow stinks!" And although I, ingratiatingly, "Hello, Sonia, auntie darling," grinned sheepishly at this wire-netting-shaded vision of my aunt's wrinkling Irani beauty, she went on, "Salim, is it? Yes, I remember you. Nasty little brat you were. Always thought you were growing up to be God or what. And why? Some stupid letter the PM's 15th assistant under-secretary must have sent you." In that first meeting, I should have been able to foresee the destruction of my plans. I should have smelled on my mad aunt the implacable odours of civil service jealousy, which would thwart all my attempts to gain a place in the world. I had been sent a letter, and she never had. It made us enemies for life. But there was a door opening, There were whiffs of clean clothes and shower baths. And I, grateful for small mercies, failed to examine the deadly perfumes of my aunt. My uncle Mustafa Aziz, whose once proudly waxed moustache had never recovered from the paralysing dust storm of the destruction of Methil's estate, had been passed over for the headship of his department no less than 47 times, and had at last found consolation for his inadequacies in thrashing his children, in ranting nightly about how he was clearly the victim of anti-Muslim prejudice, in a contradictory but absolute loyalty to the government of the day, and in an obsession with genealogies, which was his only hobby, and whose intensity was greater even than my father Ahmed Sinai's long-ago desire to prove himself descended from Mughal emperors. In the first of these consolations, he was willingly joined by his wife, the half-Irani would-be socialite Sonia, née Khosravani, who had been driven certifiably insane by a life in which she had been required to begin being a chamcha, literally a spoon, but idiomatically a flatterer, to 47 separate and successive wives of number ones, whom she had previously alienated by her manner of colossal condescension when they had been the wives of number threes. Under the joint batterings of my uncle and aunt, my cousins had by now been beaten into so thorough a pulp that I am unable to recall their number, sexes, proportions, or features. Their personalities, of course, had long since ceased to exist. In the home of Uncle Mustafa, I sat silently amongst my pulverized cousins, listening to his nightly soliloquies which contradicted themselves constantly, veering wildly between his resentment of not having been promoted and his blind lapdog devotion to every one of the Prime Minister's acts. If Indira Gandhi had asked him to commit suicide, Mustafa Aziz would have ascribed it to anti-Muslim bigotry, but also defended the statesmanship of the request, and naturally performed the task, without daring or even wishing to demur. As for genealogies, Uncle Mustafa spent all his spare time filling giant logbooks with spider-like family trees, eternally researching into and immortalizing the bizarre lineages of the greatest families in the land. But one day during my stay, my Aunt Sonia heard about a rishi from Hardwar, who was reputedly 395 years old and had memorized the genealogies of every single Brahmin clan in the country. "Even in that," she screeched at my uncle, "you end up being number two." The existence of the Hardwar Rishi completed her descent into insanity, so that her violence towards her children increased to the point at which we lived in daily expectation of murder. And in the end, my uncle Mustafa was forced to have her locked away, because her excesses were embarrassing him in his work. This, then, was the family to which I had come. Their presence in Delhi came to seem, in my eyes, like a desecration of my own past, in a city which, for me, was forever possessed by the ghosts of the young Ahmed and Amina. This terrible fly was crawling upon sacred soil. But what can never be proved for certain is that, in the years ahead, my uncle's genealogical obsession would be placed at the service of a government which was falling increasingly beneath the twin spells of power and astrology, so that what happened at the widow's hostel might never have happened without his help. But no, I have been a traitor too. I do not condemn. All I am saying is that I once saw, amongst his genealogical logbooks, a black leather folder labelled Top Secret and titled Project MCC. The end is near and cannot be escaped much longer. But while the Indira Sarkar, like her father's administration, consults daily with purveyors of occult lore, while Banarsi seers help to shape the history of India, I must digress into painful personal recollections. Because it was at Uncle Mustafa's that I learned for certain, about the deaths of my family in the War of 65, and also about the disappearance, just a few days before my arrival, of the famous Pakistani singer, Jamila Singer. When Mad Aunt Sonia heard that I had fought on the wrong side in the war, she refused to feed me. We were at dinner and screeched, "God, you have a cheek, you know that? Don't you have a brain to think with? You come to a senior civil servant's house, an escaped war criminal, Allah? You want to lose your uncle his job? You want to put us all out on the street? Catch your ears for shame, boy. Go, go, get out. Or better, we should call the police and hand you over just now. Go, be a prisoner of war. Why should we care? You are not even our departed sister's true-born son." Thunderbolts, one after the other. Salim fears for his safety and simultaneously learns the inescapable truth about his mother's death, and also that his position is weaker than he thought, because in this part of his family, the act of acceptance has not been made. Sonia, knowing what Mary Pereira confessed, is capable of anything. And I feebly, "My mother departed?" And now Uncle Mustafa, perhaps feeling that his wife has gone too far, says reluctantly,
"Never mind, Salim. Of course you must stay. He must, wife. What else to do? And poor fellow doesn't even know."
Then they told me. It occurred to me, in the heart of that crazy fly, that I owed the dead a number of mourning periods. After I learned of the demise of my mother and father and aunts Alia and Pia and Emerald, of cousins Afar and his Kiffy princess, of Reverend Mother and my distant relative Zora and her husband, I resolved to spend the next 400 days in mourning, as was right and proper. 10 mourning periods of 40 days each. And then, it was the matter of Jamila Singer. She had heard about my disappearance in the turmoil of the war in Bangladesh. She, who always showed her love when it was too late, had perhaps been driven a little crazy by the news. Jamila, the voice of Pakistan, bulbul of the faith, had spoken out against the new rulers of truncated, moth-eaten, war-divided Pakistan. While Mr. Bhutto was telling the UN Security Council, "We will build a new Pakistan, a better Pakistan. My country hearkens for me," my sister was reviling him in public. She, purest of the pure, most patriotic of patriots, turned rebel when she heard about my death. That, at least, is how I see it. All I heard from my uncle were the bald facts. He had heard them through diplomatic channels, which do not go in for psychological theorizing. 2 days after her tirade against the perpetrators of the war, my sister had vanished off the face of the earth. Uncle Mustafa tried to speak gently.
"Very bad things are happening over there, Salim. People disappearing all the time. We must fear the worst."
"No, no, no, no! Padma, he was wrong! Jamila did not disappear into the clutches of the state, because that same night I dreamed that she, in the shadows of darkness and the secrecy of a simple veil, not the instantly recognizable gold brocade tent of Uncle Puff's, but a common black burqa, fled by air from the capital city, and here she is, arriving in Karachi, unquestioned, unarrested, free. She is taking a taxi into the depths of the city, and now there is a high wall with bolted doors and a hatch through which, once long ago, I received bread, the leavened bread of my sister's weakness. She is asking to be let in. Nuns are opening doors as she cries, "Sanctuary!" Yes, there she is, safely inside. Doors being bolted behind her, exchanging one kind of invisibility for another. There is another Reverend Mother now, as Jamila Singer, who once, as the brass monkey, flirted with Christianity, finds safety, shelter, peace in the midst of the hidden order of Santa Ignacia. Yes, she is there, safe, not vanished, not in the grip of police who kick, beat, starve, but at rest. Not in an unmarked grave by the side of the Indus, but alive, baking bread, singing sweetly to the secret nuns. I know, I know, I know! How do I know? A brother knows, that's all. Responsibility assaulting me yet again, because there is no way out of it. Jamila's fall was, as usual, all my fault. I lived in the home of Mr. Mustafa Aziz for 420 days. Salim was in belated mourning for his dead. But do not think for one moment that my ears were closed. Don't assume I didn't hear what was being said around me, the repeated quarrels between uncle and aunt, which may have helped him decide to consign her to the insane asylum. Sonia Aziz yelling, "That Bhangi, that dirty, filthy fellow, not even your nephew. I don't know what's got into you. We should throw him out on his ear." And Mustafa quietly replying, "Poor chap is stricken with grief, so how can we? You just have to look to see. He is not quite right in the head, has suffered many bad things." Not quite right in the head. That was tremendous coming from them, from that family beside which a tribe of gibbering cannibals would have seemed calm and civilized. Why did I put up with it? Because I was a man with a dream. But for 420 days, it was a dream which failed to come true. Droopy mustachioed, tall but stooped, an eternal number two, my uncle Mustafa was not my uncle Hanif. He was the head of the family now, the only one of his generation to survive the Holocaust of 1965. But he gave me no help at all. I bearded him in his genealogy-filled study one bitter evening and explained, with proper solemnity and humble but resolute gestures, my historic mission to rescue the nation from her fate. But he sighed deeply and said, "Listen, Salim, what would you have me do? I keep you in my house, you eat my bread and do nothing. But that is all right. You are from my dead sister's house, and I must look after. So stay, rest, get well in yourself, then let us see. You want a clerkship or so? Maybe it can be fixed. But leave these dreams of God knows what. Our country is in safe hands. Already Indraji is making radical reforms. Land reforms, tax structures, education, birth control. You can leave it to her and her Sarkar." Patronizing me, Padma. As if I were a foolish child. Oh, the shame of it! The humiliating shame of being condescended to by dotes! At every turn I am thwarted. A prophet in the wilderness, like Maslama, like Ibn Sinan. No matter how I try, the desert is my lot. Oh, vile unhelpfulness, oh, lick-spittle uncles, oh, fettering of ambitions by second-best toadying relatives! My uncle's rejection of my pleas for preferment had one grave effect. The more he praised his Indra, the more deeply I detested her. He was, in fact, preparing me for my return to the magician's ghetto and for her, the widow. Jealousy, that was it. The great jealousy of my mad Aunt Sonia, dripping like poison into my uncle's ears, prevented him from doing a single thing to get me started on my chosen career. The great are eternally at the mercy of tiny men, and also tiny mad women. On the 418th day of my stay, there was a change in the atmosphere of the madhouse. Someone came to dinner. Someone with a plump stomach, a tapering head covered with oily curls, and a mouth as fleshy as a woman's labia. I thought I recognized him from newspaper photographs. Turning to one of my sexless, ageless, faceless cousins, I inquired with interest, "Isn't it, you know, Sanjay Gandhi?" But the pulverized creature was too annihilated to be capable of replying. Was it? Wasn't it? I did not at that time know what I now set down, that certain high-ups in that extraordinary government, and also certain unelected sons of prime ministers, had acquired the power of replicating themselves. A few years later, there would be gangs of Sanjays all over India. No wonder that incredible dynasty wanted to impose birth control on the rest of us. So maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but someone disappeared into my uncle's study with Mustafa Aziz, and that night I sneaked a look. There was a locked black leather folder saying Top Secret and also Project MCC, and the next morning my uncle was looking at me differently, with fear almost, or with that special look of loathing which civil servants reserve for those who fall into official disfavour. I should have known then what was in store for me, but everything is simple with hindsight. Hindsight comes to me now too late. Now that I am finally consigned to the peripheries of history, now that the connections between my life and the nation's have broken for good and all. To avoid my uncle's inexplicable gaze, I went out into the garden and saw Parvati the witch. She was squatting on the pavement with the basket of invisibility by her side. When she saw me, her eyes brightened with reproach. "You said you'd come, but you never, so I..." She stuttered. I bowed my head. "I have been in mourning," I said lamely. And she, "But still you could have..." "My God, Salim, you don't know. In our colony I can't tell anyone about my real magic, never. Not even Picture Singh, who is like a father. I must bottle it and bottle it, because they don't believe in such things. And I thought, here is Salim come. Now, at last, I will have one friend. We can talk. We can be together. We have both been and known and, are, how to say it, Salim? You don't care. You got what you wanted and went off just like that. I am nothing to you. I know." That night, my mad aunt Sonia, herself only days away from confinement in a straitjacket — it got into the papers, a small piece, on an inside page, my uncle's department must have been annoyed — had one of the fierce inspirations of the profoundly insane, and burst into the bedroom into which, half an hour earlier, someone with saucer eyes had climbed through a ground-floor window. She found me in bed with Parvati the witch, and after that my uncle Mustafa lost interest in sheltering me, saying, "You were born from Bungis. You will remain a dirty type all your life." On the 420th day after my arrival, I left my uncle's house. Deprived of family ties, returned at last to that true inheritance of poverty and destitution of which I had been cheated for so long by the crime of Mary Pereira. Parvati the witch was waiting for me on the pavement. I did not tell her that there was a sense in which I had been glad of the interruption, because as I kissed her in the dark of that illicit midnight, I had seen her face changing, becoming the face of a forbidden love. The ghostly features of Jamila Singer replaced those of the witch girl. Jamila, who was, I know it, safely hidden in a Karachi nunnery, was suddenly also here, except that she had undergone a dark transformation. She had begun to rot. The dreadful pustules and cankers of forbidden love were spreading across her face, just as once the ghost of Joe DaCosta had rotted in the grip of the occult leprosy of guilt. So now the rancid flowers of incest blossomed on my sister's phantasmal features, and I couldn't do it, couldn't kiss, touch, look upon that intolerable spectral face. I had been on the verge of jerking away with a cry of desperate nostalgia and shame when Sonia Aziz burst in upon us with electric light and screams. And as for Mustafa, well, my indiscretion with poverty may also have been, in his eyes, no more than a useful pretext for getting rid of me. But that must remain in doubt, because the black folder was locked. All I have to go on is a look in his eye, a smell of fear, three initials on a label, because afterwards, when everything was finished, a fallen lady and her labia-lipped son spent 2 days behind locked doors, burning files. And how can we know whether or not one of them was labelled MCC? I didn't want to stay anyway. Family. An overrated idea. Don't think I was sad. Never for a moment imagined that lumps rose in my throat at my expulsion from the last gracious home open to me. I tell you, I was in fine spirits when I left. Maybe there is something unnatural about me. Some fundamental lack of emotional response. But my thoughts have always aspired to higher things. Hence my resilience. Hit me, I bounce back. But no resistance is of any use against the cracks. To sum up, forsaking my earlier, naive hopes of preferment in public service, I return to the magician's slum and the chaya of the Friday mosque. Like Gautama, the first and true Buddha, I left my life and comfort and went like a beggar into the world. The date was February 23, 1973. Coal mines and the wheat market were being nationalized. The price of oil had begun to spiral up, 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 would quadruple in a year. And in the Communist Party of India, the split between Dange's Moscow faction and Namburudripad's CPIM had become unbridgeable. And I, Salim Sanai, like India, was 25 years, 6 months, and 8 days old. The magicians were communists almost to a man. That's right. Reds. Insurrectionists. Public menaces. The scum of the earth. A community of the godless living blasphemously in the very shadow of the house of God. Shameless. What's more, innocently scarlet. Born with the bloody taint upon their souls. And let me say at once that no sooner had I discovered this than I, who had been raised in India's other true faith, which we may term businessism, and who had been abandoned by its practitioners, felt instantly and comfortingly at home. A renegade businessist, I began zealously to turn red and then redder, as surely and completely as my father had once turned white, so that now my mission of saving the country could be seen in a new light. More revolutionary methodologies suggested themselves. Down with the rule of uncooperative boxwaller uncles and their beloved leaders. Full of thoughts of direct communication with the masses, I settled into the magician's colony, scraping a living by amusing foreign and native tourists with the marvellous perspicacities of my nose, which enabled me to smell out their simple touristy secrets. Picture Singh asked me to share his shack. I slept on tattered sackcloth, amongst baskets sibilant with snakes. But I did not mind, just as I found myself capable of tolerating hunger, thirst, mosquitoes, and, in the beginning, the bitter cold of a Delhi winter. This Picture Singh, the most charming man in the world, was also the ghetto's unquestioned chieftain. Squabbles and problems were resolved beneath the shade of his ubiquitous and enormous black umbrella, and I, who could read and write as well as smell, became a sort of aide-de-camp to this monumental man, who invariably added a lecture on socialism to his serpentine performances, and who was famous in the main streets and alleys of the city for more than his snake charmer skills. I can say with utter certainty that Picture Singh was the greatest man I ever met. One afternoon, during the chaya, the ghetto was visited by another copy of that labia-lipped youth whom I'd seen at my Uncle Mustafa's. Standing on the steps of the mosque, he unfurled a banner which was then held up by two assistants. It read, "Abolish poverty," and bore the cow-suckling calf symbol of the Indra Congress. His face looked remarkably like a plump calf's face, and he unleashed a typhoon of halitosis when he spoke.
"Brothers all, sisters all, what does Congress say to you? This, that all men are created equal."
He got no further. The crowd recoiled from his breath of bullock dung under a hot sun, and Picture Singh began to guffaw.
"Captain Too Good, sir,"
and lab your lips foolishly. "Okay, you brother, won't you share the joke?" Picture Singh shook his head, clutched his sides.
"Oh, speech, Captain, absolute master speech."
His laughter rolled out from beneath his umbrella to infect the crowd, until all of us were rolling on the ground, laughing, crushing ants, getting covered in dust. And the Congress Mooncalf's voice rose in panic.
"What is this? This fellow doesn't think we are equals? What a low impression he must have!"
But now Picture Singh, umbrella overhead, was striding away towards his hut. Labia Lips, in relief, continued his speech. But not for long, because Picture returned, carrying under his left arm a small, circular-lidded basket, and under his right armpit a wooden flute. He placed the basket on the step beside the Congresswallah's feet, removed the lid, raised flute to lips. Amid renewed laughter, the young politico leapt 19 inches into the air as a king cobra swayed sleepily up from its home. Labia Lips is crying, "What are you doing? Trying to kill me to death?" And Picture Singh, ignoring him, his umbrella furled now, plays on, more and more furiously, and the snake uncoils faster, faster. Picture Singh plays until the flute's music fills every cranny of the slum and threatens to scale the walls of the mosque. And at last, the great snake, hanging in the air, supported only by the enchantment of the tune, stands 9 feet long out of the basket and dances on its tail. Picture Singh relents. Nagaraj subsides into coils. The most charming man in the world offers the flute to the Congress youth.
"Okay, Captain," Picture Singh says agreeably, "you give it a try."
But Labia Lips, "Man, you know I couldn't do it." Whereupon Picture Singh seizes the cobra just below the head, opens his own mouth wide, 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 displaying an heroic wreckage of teeth and gums. Winking left-eyed at the Congress youth, he inserts the snake's tongue-flicking head into his hideously yawning orifice. A full minute passes before Picture Singh returns the cobra to its basket. Very kindly, he tells the youth,
"You see, Captain, here is the truth of the business. Some persons are better, others are less. But it may be nice for you to think otherwise."
Watching this scene, Salim Sanai learned that Picture Singh and the magicians were people whose hold on reality was absolute. They gripped it so powerfully that they could bend it every which way in the service of their arts, but they never forgot what it was. The problems of the magicians' ghetto were the problems of the communist movement in India. Within the confines of the colony could be found, in miniature, the many divisions and dissensions which racked the party in the country. Picture Singh, I hasten to add, was above it all. The patriarch of the ghetto, he was the possessor of an umbrella whose shade could restore harmony to the squabbling factions. But the disputes which were brought into the shelter of the snake charmer's umbrella were becoming more and more bitter as the prestidigitators, the pullers of rabbits from hats, aligned themselves firmly behind Mr. Dange's Moscow Line official CPI, which supported Mrs. Gandhi throughout the emergency. The contortionists, however, began to lean more towards the left and the slanting intricacies of the Chinese-oriented wing. Fire-eaters and sword-swallowers applauded the guerrilla tactics of the Naxalite movement, while mesmerists and walkers on hot coals espoused Nambu Dhirupad's manifesto, neither Muscovite nor Pekingese, and deplored the Naxalites' violence. There were Trotskyist tendencies amongst card-sharpers and even a communism-through-the-ballot-box movement amongst the moderate members of the ventriloquist section. I had entered a milieu in which, while religious and regionalist bigotry were wholly absent, our ancient national gift for vociferousness had found new outlets. Picture Singh told me, sorrowfully, that during the 1971 general election, a bizarre murder had resulted from the quarrel between a Naxalite fire-eater and a Moscow Line conjurer who, incensed by the former's views, had attempted to draw a pistol from his magic hat. But no sooner had the weapon been produced than the supporter of Ho Chi Minh had scorched his opponent to death in a burst of terrifying flame. Under his umbrella, Picture Singh spoke of a socialism which owed nothing to foreign influences. "Listen, captains," he told warring ventriloquists and puppeteers. "Will you go to your villages and talk about Stalins and Maos? Will Bihari or Tamil peasants care about the killing of Trotsky?" The chaya of his magical umbrella cooled the most intemperate of the wizards, and had the effect on me of convincing me that one day soon the snake charmer Picture Singh would follow in the footsteps of Mean Abdullah so many years ago, that, like the legendary hummingbird, he would leave the ghetto to shape the future by the sheer force of his will, and that, unlike my grandfather's hero, he would not be stopped until he and his cause had won the day. But... always a but. What happened. We all know that. Before I return to telling the story of my private life, I should like it to be known that it was Picture Singh who revealed to me that the country's corrupt black economy had grown as large as the official white variety, which he did by showing me a newspaper photograph of Mrs. Gandhi. Her hair, parted in the centre, was snow white on one side and black as night on the other, so that, depending on which profile she presented, she resembled either a stoat or an ermine. Recurrence of the centre parting in history, and also economy as an analogue of a prime ministerial hairstyle. I owe these important perceptions to the most charming man in the world. Picture Singh it was who told me that Mishra, the railway minister, was also the officially appointed minister for bribery, through whom the biggest deals in the black economy were cleared, and who arranged for payoffs to appropriate ministers and officials. Without Picture Singh, I might never have known about the poll fixing in the state elections in Kashmir. He was no lover of democracy, however.
"God damn this election business, Captain," he told me. "Whenever they come, something bad happens and our countrymen behave like clowns."
I, in the grip of my fever for revolution, failed to take issue with my mentor. There were, of course, a few exceptions to the ghetto's rules. One or two conjurers retained their Hindu faith and, in politics, espoused the Hindu sectarian Jana Sangh Party, or the notorious Ananda Marg extremists. There were even Swatantra voters amongst the jugglers. Non-politically speaking, the old lady Resham Bibi was one of the few members of the community who remained an incurable fantasist, believing, for instance, in the superstition which forbade women to climb mango trees because a mango tree, which had once borne the weight of a woman, would bear sour fruit forevermore. And there was the strange fakir named Chishti Khan, whose face was so smooth and lustrous that nobody knew whether he was 19 or 90, and who had surrounded his shack with a fabulous creation of bamboo sticks and scraps of brightly coloured paper, so that his home looked like a miniature multicoloured replica of the nearby Red Fort. Only when you passed through its castellated gateway did you realise that behind the meticulously hyperbolic facade of bamboo and paper crenellations and ravelins hid a tin and cardboard hovel, like all the rest. Chishti Khan had committed the ultimate solecism of permitting his illusionist expertise to infect his real life. He was not popular in the ghetto. The magicians kept their distance, lest they become diseased by his dreams. So you will understand why Parvati the witch, the possessor of truly wondrous powers, had kept them secret all her life. The secret of her midnight-given gifts would not have been easily forgiven by a community which had constantly denied such possibilities. On the blind side of the Friday Mosque, where the magicians were out of sight, and the only danger was from scavengers after scrap, from searches for abandoned crates, or hunters for corrugated tin, that was where Parvati the Witch, eager as mustard, showed me what she could do. In a humbi shalwar kameez constructed from the ruins of a dozen others, Midnight Sorceress performed for me with the verve and enthusiasm of a child. Saucer eye, rope-like ponytail, fine full red lips. I would never have resisted her for so long if not for the face, the sick, decaying eyes, nose, lips of... There seemed at first to be no limits to Parvati's abilities. But there were. Well then. Were demons conjured? Did jinns appear, offering riches and overseas travel on levitating rugs? Were frogs turned into princes and did stones metamorphose into jewels? Was there selling of souls and raising of the dead? Not a bit of it. The magic which Parvati the Witch performed for me, the only magic she was ever willing to perform, was of the type known as white. It was as though the Brahmin's secret book, the Atharva Veda, had revealed all its secrets to her. She could cure disease and counter poisons. To prove this, she permitted snakes to bite her and fought the venom with a strange ritual involving praying to the snake god Takshasa, drinking water infused with the goodness of the Krimukha tree, and the powers of old boiled garments, and reciting a spell. Garudamand, the eagle, drank of poison, but it was powerless. In a like manner have I deflected its power, as an arrow is deflected. She could cure sores and consecrate talismans. She knew the Saraktya charm and the rite of the tree. And all this in a series of extraordinary nighttime displays she revealed to me beneath the walls of the mosque. But still she was not happy. As ever, I am obliged to accept responsibility. The scent of mournfulness which hung around Parvati the Witch was my creation. Because she was 25 years old and wanted more from me than my willingness to be her audience. God knows why, but she wanted me in her bed, or, to be precise, to lie with her on the length of sackcloth which served her for a bed in the hovel she shared with a family of contortionist triplets from Kerala. Three girls who were orphans, just like her. Just like myself. What she did for me. Under the power of her magic, hair began to grow where none had grown since Mr. Zagalo pulled too hard. Her wizardry caused the birthmarks on my face to fade under the healing applications of herbal poultices. It seemed that even the bandiness of my legs was diminishing under her care. She could do nothing, however, for my one bad ear. There is no magic on earth strong enough to wipe out the legacies of one's parents. But no matter how much she did for me, I was unable to do for her the thing she desired most, because although we lay down together beneath the walls on the blind side of the mosque, the moonlight showed me her nighttime face turning, always turning into that of my distant, vanished sister. No! Not my sister, into the putrid, vilely disfigured face of Jamila Singer. Parvati anointed her body with unguent oils imbued with erotic charm. She combed her hair 1,000 times with a comb made from aphrodisiac deer bones, and, I do not doubt it, in my absence she must have tried all manner of lovers' sorceries. But I was in the grip of an older bewitchment, and could not, it seemed, be released. I was doomed to find the faces of women who loved me, turning into the features of... But you know whose crumbling features appeared, filling my nostrils with their unholy stench. Poor girl, Padma sighs, and I agree. But until the widow drained me of past, present, future, I remained under the monkey spell. When Parvati the Witch finally admitted failure, her face developed overnight an alarming and pronounced pout. She fell asleep in the hut of the contortionist orphans and awoke with her lips stuck in a protruding attitude of unutterably sensuous pique. Orphaned triplets told her, giggling worriedly, what had happened to her face. She tried spiritedly to pull her features back into position, but neither muscles nor wizardry managed to restore her to her former self. At last, resigning herself to her tragedy, Parvati gave in, so that Reshim Bibi told anyone who would listen,
"That poor girl, a god must have blown on her when she was making a face."
That year, incidentally, the chic ladies of the cities were all wearing just such an expression, with erotic deliberation. The haughty mannequins in the Eleganza 73 fashion show all pouted as they walked their catwalks. In the awful poverty of the magician's slum, pouting Parvati the witch was in the height of facial fashion. The magicians devoted much of their energies to the problem of making Parvati smile again, taking time off from their work, and also from the more mundane chores of reconstructing tin and cardboard huts which had fallen down in a high wind, or killing rats. They performed their most difficult tricks for her pleasure. But the pout remained in place. Reshim Bibi made a green tea which smelled of camphor and forced it down Parvati's gullet. The tea had the effect of constipating her so thoroughly that she was not seen defecating behind her hovel for 9 weeks. Two young jugglers conceived the notion that she might have begun grieving for her deceased father all over again, and applied themselves to the task of drawing his portrait on a shred of old tarpaulin which they hung above her sackcloth mat. Triplets made jokes, and Picture Singh, greatly distressed, made cobras tie themselves in knots, but none of it worked. Because if Parvati's thwarted love was beyond her own powers to cure, what hope could the others have had? The power of Parvati's pout created in the ghetto a nameless sense of unease, which all the magician's animosity towards the unknown could not entirely dispel. And then Reshim Bibi hit upon an idea.
"Fools that we are," she told Picture Singh. "We don't see what is under our noses. The poor girl is 25, Baba, almost an old woman. She is pining for a husband."
Picture Singh was impressed.
"Reshim Bibi," he told her approvingly, "your brain is not yet dead."
After that, Picture Singh applied himself to the task of finding Parvati a suitable young man. Many of the young men in the ghetto were coaxed, bullied, threatened. A number of candidates were produced, but Parvati rejected them all. On the night when she told Bismillah Khan, the most promising fire-eater in the colony, to go somewhere else with his breath of hot chilies, even Picture Singh despaired. "That night," he said to me,
"Captain, that girl is a trial and a grief to me. She is your good friend. You got any ideas?"
Then an idea occurred to him, an idea which had had to wait until he became desperate because even Picture Singh was affected by considerations of class. Automatically thinking of me as too good for Parvati because of my supposedly higher birth, the aging communist had not thought until now that I might be.
"Tell me one thing, Captain," Picture Singh asked shyly. "You are planning to be married some day."
Salim Sanai felt panic rising up inside himself.
"Hey, listen, Captain. You like the girl, hey?"
And I, unable to deny it, "Of course." And now Picture Singh, grinning from ear to ear while snakes hissed in baskets.
"Like her a lot, Captain. A lot.
But I was thinking of Jamila's face in the night and made a desperate decision. "Picture G, I can't marry her." And now he, frowning,
You may be married already, Captain. Got wife, children waiting somewhere?"
"Nothing for it now." I quietly, shamefully said, "I can't marry anyone, Picture G. I can't have children. The silence in the shack was punctuated by sibilant snakes and the calls of wild dogs in the night.
You're telling truth, Captain. Is a medical fact?
Yes.
Because one must not lie about such things, Captain. To lie about one's manhood is bad, bad luck. Anything could happen, Captain.
And I, wishing upon myself the curse of Nadir Khan, which was also the curse of my uncle Hanif Aziz, and, during the freeze and its long aftermath, of my father Amit Sinai, was goaded into lying even more angrily. I tell you, Salim cried, it is true, and that's that.
Then, Captain, Picture G said tragically, smacking wrist against forehead, God knows what to do with that poor girl.
A wedding. I married Parvati the Witch on February 23, 1975, the second anniversary of my outcast's return to the magician's ghetto. Stiffening of Padma. Taut as a washing line, my dung lotus inquires, Married? But last night only you said you wouldn't, and why you haven't told me all these days, weeks, months? I look at her sadly and remind her that I have already mentioned the death of my poor Parvati, which was not a natural death. Slowly, Padma uncoils as I continue. Women have made me and also unmade. From Reverend Mother to the widow and even beyond, I have been at the mercy of the so-called, erroneously in my opinion, gentler sex. It is perhaps a matter of connection. Is not Mother India, Bharat Mata, commonly thought of as female? And, as you know, there's no escape from her. There have been 32 years in this story during which I remained unborn. Soon I may complete 31 years of my own. For 63 years before and after midnight, women have done their best and also, I'm bound to say, their worst. In a blind landowner's house on the shores of a Kashmiri lake, Nazim Aziz doomed me to the inevitability of perforated sheets, and in the waters of that same lake, Ilsa Lubin leaked into history, and I have not forgotten her death wish. Before Nadir Khan hid in his underworld, my grandmother had, by becoming Reverend Mother, begun a sequence of women who changed their names, a sequence which continues even today, and which even leaked into Nadir, who became Kasim and sat with dancing hands at the Pioneer Cafe. And after Nadir's departure, my mother, Mumtaz Aziz, became Amina Sinai. And Alia, with the bitterness of ages, who clothed me in the baby things impregnated with her old maid fury. And Emerald, who laid a table on which I made Pepper Potts march. There was the Rani of Kuchnaheen, whose money, placed at the disposal of a humming man, gave birth to the optimism disease, which has recurred at intervals ever since, and, in the Muslim quarter of Old Delhi, a distant relative called Zora, whose flirtations gave birth in my father, to that later weakness for Fernandas and Flories. So to Bombay, where Winky's Vanita could not resist the centre parting of William Methold, and Nussie the Duck lost a baby race, while Mary Pereira, in the name of love, changed the baby tags of history and became a second mother to me. Women and women and women. Toxie Catrack nudging open the door, which would later let in the children of midnight. The terrors of her nurse Bayap, the competitive love of Amina and Mary, and what my mother showed me while I lay concealed in a washing chest. Yes, the black mango.